Welcome to Theatre Voice, the V&A's archive of conversations with leading theatre practitioners. I'm Tim Banno, I'm the editor of Theatre Voice. 10 years ago, I was blown away by a play called The Solid Life of Sugar Water at the Edinburgh Fringe, a beautiful and harrowing piece of work by Jack Thorne about a couple who try to come together after a terrible loss. It was produced by Grey Eye, the pioneering company who put deaf, disabled and neurodivergent artists centre stage, and it was directed by Amit Sharma. Then, fairly near the beginning of his directorial career, there was a vertical bed, I remember. There was integrated captioning. It was a brilliant piece of theatre. I've still got strong memories of it a decade on. Now, though, Amit is the artistic director of London's Kiln Theatre. He's taken over from Indu Ruba Singham as she's gone off to run the National Theatre. In between, Amit has worked at the Royal Exchange in Manchester and at Birmingham Rep, where he served as Deputy Artistic Director. And he's branched out into TV, co-directing then Barbara Met Allen for the BBC, as well as working on Cryptales, which earned a BAFTA nomination. Amit's first show as Artistic Director at the Kiln was the brilliant Retrograde by Ryan Calais Cameron, a 50s set thriller about the actor Sidney Poitier. In this interview, we talk about that play. He talks about getting his feet under the desk at the Kiln 18 months on and what we can expect from his tenure there.
So tell me how long exactly you've been artistic director at the Kiln, because it's not been that long.
It's not been long. It's about 18 months.
Do you feel settled, feet under the desk, or is it still a bit of a blur?
It's definitely not a blur. I'm kind of getting there when it comes to like feet under the desk. I've got a clear sense of what I would like to do with this place. And there's a great team of people here who, you know, really kind of believe, even before I kind of arrived. I mean, you know, I was reading a couple of days ago about the term legacy, and sometimes legacy is about looking backwards. And actually, legacies are about platforming forwards. And I feel as if I've been really fortunate in Indu's legacy and what she's created here and what she's given me, the rest of the organization, but also Kilburn. Is a place where, you know, people feel very passionate about it. People feel like it's theirs. People feel like they're represented. People, you know, who perhaps in other organizations feel they have to exist because they're part of the ecology. But here they feel like they can just be artists. Mm. And, you know, and they're from different kind of backgrounds. And there's something about that setup that's just allowed us to kind of go, right, so how do we amplify that further? How do we make sure that we are really representing as many voices as possible? Still creating good quality work, because we're kind of interested in that. Yeah, and just being the small powerhouse that we kind of are. So also being the associate here for about 18 months too really gave me an opportunity to kind of understand how the organization worked and what it was kind of trying to do. But having said that, Tim, I was absolutely bowled over. I was shocked when I was kind of offered it. When the chair rang me up to kind of go, we'd like to offer you the job, I was stunned in silence. I'm not usually stunned in silence. I'm not really a silent person. but it was. I was so stunned that the chair went, hello, because they thought that there was like an interruption on the on the call. And kind of dropped out. But
it was a brutal interview process, wasn't it? It was sort of three rounds.
It was hard. It was hard.
What kind of things do they, I mean, what does that even involve, interviewing for an artistic director of a major London theatre? Like, what are they asking you?
Well, they kind of like, you know, want to ask you about, you know, your background. You know, they're trying to get a sense of, I assume, they're trying to get a sense of what's kind of led you to what experience you have. Some of the things that are really important to the Kiln, not just about what we put on our stage, but our creative engagement work as well, where that fits in terms of, you know, one's values. And so they're going to get an overall sense of that and how you kind of present and how you're going to kind of talk, because fundamentally you're going to have to talk to all sorts of stakeholders, whether it's audiences, whether it's funders, whether it's donors, you know, whether you're invited to speak about the organization to people who are looking to be inspired by you, or you're in schools, or, you know, whatever. So there's an element of that. The incredibly hard part is when you're trying to go, this is what the vision is going to be. Mm. And this is what you would like to kind of program. And this is the kind of work that you want to kind of put on. And people kind of like going, well, that's good, but what about X, Y, and Z? And, you know, really kind of pulling it apart. And yeah, so it was a three-part process. And when I kind of came out of the interview, I thought I'd flunked it. I thought like, oh my
really?
God. I just thought, because it's hard. They're really like, it's 45 minutes of like real intensity. And this wasn't the first time I went for an interview for a job, but I remember the first job that I went for, artistic director job. It was so bad, Tim. I'm still kind of scarred from it. But it was so bad that actually I realized I'd not been in a room to do interviews for about 15, 20 years, because
Yeah.
the cycle of freelance artists is that you meet a person on an individual level, you try to sell your show, you try to sell your ideas, and that's how it kind of works. So then to be in front of a panel, and they're asking
Yeah.
you different kind of things, it's really quite hard. And even though I've been through a few of those processes, it's really intense.
The version that you're pitching in the in those interviews, how much can that match with the reality now that you're actually in that job? Like, are you able to do the things that you were talking about in that interview, or do aspects of real life kind of get in the way?
What I've said in the interview, I'm kind of doing. So, one of the things that I said was that I wanted to, broaden our income stream, for example. That's not kind of art related, but it is art related, because if we can broaden our income stream, it means that we can support the work that we kind of put on, which is probably a bit more of a shift of what's kind of come before. So we're really making inroads on that. We're still kind of, and this is the difficult thing, right? Indu is like an incredible artistic director, and was an incredible artistic director for this place. We have to still maintain the standards, the quality, the insight, and invite those exceptional artists to kind of come through to kind of work with us. So, that's part of the role, that's part of the job, and that was part of what I was said I was going to do, and that's what we're doing as well. But we also have to kind of recognize that we are part of an ecology. So, we're not the National, we're not the IRC, we're not these big organizations with those huge reputations. We're smaller, but our reputation is just as big. But it's just kind of different. So we have to be part of people's journeys to who are going to write for the National, the IRC, or some of these larger organizations, or television and film. We want to be part of that pathway and that journey as well. So it's not just a it's just a case of going, we have to have the person with the most level of experience here. We also have to invest in those people who have written in those smaller spaces, who are looking for their mid-scale kind of jump, and being able to kind of support that and deliver for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. I was thinking about this yesterday because I was at the Bush, and it just reminded me how, kind of extraordinary it is that there are places like the Kiln and the Bush that are just constantly platforming new voices and all voices who are kind of taking that next step up. And but also, because I was there on a Wednesday matinee, that there are people who are going to see it on a Wednesday matinee. It was like, it wasn't full. It was about two-thirds full though, which is astonishing that a tiny theatre in West London is two-thirds full on a Wednesday matinee. There is such a hunger out there, and people are really up for seeing this stuff. But the places where that stuff's being staged are getting squeezed and squeezed.
Yeah, and I don't feel as if there's ever been a golden age of money when it comes to arts and working with Grey Eye, and looking at the history of Grey Eye in the mid 80s, Grey Eye had their funding cut. They were kind of brought back into not quite the portfolio, but they got the Arts Council funding kind of back. So there's always been this push and pull when it comes to finances and kind of comes to money, and we just have to find ways of being a bit more resilient as much as we can. It's not easy, particularly because the pandemic has had a catastrophic impact on audiences coming back. That's why we have to look at that, and we are looking at other ways that we can kind of like bridge that kind of gap.
What are those ways? I mean, where do you even start looking?
Just getting under the bonnet going, what do we do? We've been fortunate enough just to have the cinema space kind of refurbished, and as part of that, we've got like an events and hires manager who is now looking at hiring the space out during the day or in the evening. We're hosting screenings in there. So we had the former Irish president do her documentary in there. We had Mike Leigh do a preview screening of Hard Truths in there. So it's just looking at those opportunities where we know that people will come, they'll spend money in the bar, hopefully, but they'll start to have more of a kind of investment. We're also doing like book launches. We're working with an organization called Intelligence Squared. That's what they kind of do. So it's creating those partnerships that bring those audiences that we might not be able to tap into, for them to engage with us as a building, as an organization. And then hopefully that transpires in a way where they kind of go, oh, actually, I'm going to go and see this show. I'm going to go see that film in the kind of cinema. So it's trying to be as entrepreneurial, which is probably a word, artists kind of go, well, why do we have to be all those sort of things? And quite rightly. But we just have to find different ways of appealing to a much more wider audience.
What about ticket prices? Because, I mean, I would say the Kiln's pretty good value still. Like, what's your top price? About £40, something like that.
£40. Yeah, our top price is £40. We've just introduced a new thing for previews for local residents. £5 preview tickets are cheapest. Usually it's between £10 and £15.
£5 is insane in 2025 for a ticket to the theatre. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah, but part of the reason is that, we know that there are affluent members of our community that, can pay a bit more. But also, we have to really respond to the community that we're in. Kilburn is not affluent in any which way or shape or form. Part of the vision here is to kind of go, actually, theatre can be for anyone. Not for everyone, but it can be for anyone. So how do we start to engage those audiences, particularly through some of the programs that we do as well? We do a program called Arrive, Build, Create, which is working with young people who are newly arrived, who are seeking asylum or refugee status. And so we're doing this work with them using drama as a way of it's a way of kind of settling them in, supporting their English, and also just to get a community and a network kind of going. But then, we can't kind of go, you can come and do this work with us, but then, those local people, you've got to pay £15, £20 to come and see a ticket. But hopefully they can, find that £5, or we go, here's a comp for you, because the investment just isn't that program. The investment is kind of going, we want to show you that theatre can be for you. So you, if you want to go on that journey with us, we're accessible and we're available to kind of do it.
So in terms of programming, what's your approach there? I know that, you're directing a lot personally. So I think when you started, you did the first two productions and
Yeah,
this
it was so ego driven.
Why not? You're the boss. Do what you want.
Well, what was really interesting was I kind of spent the first 6 to 8 months doing a lot of kind of administrative kind of part of the job. And we were recruiting for a new ED and all that kind of stuff. And I just thought, I'm just going to give myself a target to kind of aim for. Just before it was going to be announced, the first season, I spoke to Indu and I said, I'm doing two shows back to back. She went, oh my God. I went, what? She went, that's what I did.
Oh,
I went, really? She went, yeah. She did the Lolita's play,
yeah,
and
Red Velvet.
Red Velvet, and she did Paper Dolls, sorry,
Yeah.
Octopus as well. Yeah,
Yeah. Oh, what? And so you both had to play with the word dolls in your first season
I
of
know. I
Shanghai
mean,
Dolls, Paper
look
Dolls.
at. I mean, like, there's something that was kind of in the atmosphere, just kind of around it. And I said to her, do you think it should be traditions, or whoever comes after me, they should do the first two shows? Having done it, it's just like, listen, I'm not sure about it. It can kind of like break your back and break your spirit as well.
And
But
then retrogrades in the West End as well. The fantastic retrograde. I mean, such a good show that.
thank you, thank you.
But that was, you directed that when you were associate, right? So that was before when Indy was still in charge.
That's right. And it was the first play that I read at Kiln. Indu sent me like a few plays, and that was the first one I read. And I thought, I'll just read the first 20 odd pages, and then, got to the end of it, and I was like, right, I've got to email to find out who's directing this. Fingers crossed, no one kind of is. And she said, well, there isn't, but if you're interested. And then I met with Ryan, and he was directing for Black Boys at the Royal Court at that time. And we sat and we chatted, and we got along. We really spoke about the play and the themes that were in it, and our experience of discrimination just as much as what Sydney kind of goes through. So I just think it's an incredible, incredible play. And yeah, he's an immense artist.
And just to explain for anyone who doesn't know, so it's by Ryan Callie Cameron, brilliant writer, and it's a kind of taut 90-minute thriller about legendary actor Sidney Poitier and sort of on the cusp of his big break and being pulled into the office of a kind of TV exec and then faced with a very, very difficult moral question. It's the 1950s. The only word you need to know is McCarthy, basically. But it's fantastic. It's so good. And Ivana Jeremiah playing Sidney Poitier. Oh my God, absolutely incredible. What a talent. So let's rewind right back to the beginning. Where did this all start for you? Was it a theatre loving household you grew up in? Were you in the West End every night or not?
Really not. I grew up on a council estate in Southall, and weirdly, I grew up in a Hindu family, and astrology was a very big part of it. And the stars had kind of said that he is going to go into the arts, so encourage that line of work. And so that's what my parents did. They didn't grow up here. They grew up in India. I was born in India, and I came over when I was about 8 months old. So, the kind of structures around theatre and arts and culture just wasn't, it wasn't in our grasp really. And that's where, school and education was so important, because they really, they really kind of encouraged that. And so we went to pantos, and we went to shows for children. And then having those two very vivid kind of like, influences, teachers and parents and the astrology side of things. The path was, I was thought I'm going to be an actor. So I did a bit of kind of like, stuff at school, and I did some amateur stuff when I was a teenager, local community kind of like a production. And then I was at university studying film media production at High Wycombe at Bucks University. And I got a letter through the post by an organization called the London Disability Arts Forum. I never heard of them, don't know how they got my information, but they said that a company called Grey Eye were setting up a course called The Missing Piece. And it was, specifically for disabled people who just don't get, the opportunity to go to drama school and train up to be actors. So I applied, and it's life changing. It's life changing. I mean, Grey Eye and Jenny and the support that she's kind of given, if that didn't happen, I just wouldn't be, I'd be in a different career path altogether.
When was that? What sort
Last
of
century. Yeah, I know, right? And I look so young. It was around 1999. Yeah, 98, 99.
is amazing. It's amazing to think how long Grey Eye have been going and doing the work that they've been doing. Just an extraordinary company. As you say, Jenny Seeley, I mean, what an absolute legend of, just incredible.
Superstar, an absolute superstar. And it wasn't just that it changed me artistically, it changed me politically as well. So, we'd never at school really been taught about the social model of disability and what that kind of meant. And I learned that through Grey Eye, and I learned that through my interactions with some of the stalwart performers who are absolutely brilliant, and nowadays would be on, the stages that we can kind of take for granted. But back then, it was Grey Eye or other disabled-led organizations that were given the opportunity to either write, perform, direct, et cetera, et cetera. So, it was very much life-changing for me. And then, I was basically a jobbing actor. I worked with the Unicorn. I worked with an organization called Immediate Theatre, doing a lot of work in schools. And with young people, I worked with Christine Landon Smith and Sudha Butcher at Tamasha, and the opportunities that they kind of gave. And I thought, like, this is kind of it now, that, and I did that for about 10 years. And, Christine was very, as Jenny was, just really giving in going, look, there's this show or this play reading that we're doing, and would you be interested in being an assistant director? So I was just kind of like balancing that up. And directing, it was so funny, because the first show I did for Grey Eye was an adaptation of Wojtek, which was directed by the very brilliant Philip Osman. And I'm like 19, 20 at this time, and there's no filter, and I'm in the rehearsal room. An amazing actor called Jason Taylor was playing Wojtek, and he's a BSL user, and all the actors were voicing over for him, and it was very kind of, it was an incredible piece of work. And so I'm not there performing, I'm there watching, and Philip's there directing, and I keep saying to him when he's making a decision, I go, yeah, but wouldn't it be better if that person did that, and da, 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 and he goes, yeah, no, yeah, thank you for that. And then he and then I after about four or five times, the stage management kind of like tapped me on the shoulder and went, we've got some lines to learn. But he was really gracious in kind of going, by being irritated by me, but also just going, listen to Jenny, he's got an eye for directing, like, just kind of keep an eye on them and eye on him. And so with Jenny, with Christine, with Tony at Unicorn, I did a few kind of like assisting gigs. And then about 10 years later, I could feel my body changing. I'd done a lot of touring. And the stamina of my body wasn't as young as it was before. And so I kind of had a kind of like, decision to kind of make as to whether how I was going to kind of adapt and earn a living. And then Jenny became the co-artistic director of the Paralympics opening ceremony along with Bradley Hemmings. And she said, look, I'm gonna be seconded to that. Do you want, would you be interested in becoming the associate director and overseeing the artistic activity for about 8 months at Greyhound? And I was like, yeah, I would absolutely love to kind of do that. And she goes, well, I'm going to give you a show. And we were going to do Ted Hughes' The Iron Man, which Jenny had directed before, and I'd do a version of that. And so I was there for about 8 months. And in the end, I didn't do Iron Man. I did a co-directed a piece called Prometheus Awakes with Lafura Del Bows, who at that time, sometimes like it's really great to not to know the reputations of organizations and people,
Yeah.
because when I said yes and started working with Pera, the other director, I didn't know that they'd done the Barcelona opening ceremony of the Olympics in '92. We made a production I was really kind of proud of, and then the literary manager at Grey Eye, Carissa, went, look, here's a script. It's written by Jack Thorne. Just have a read of it. Let me know what you think. And it was A Solid Life of Sugar Water, and I bit like how I felt when I read Retrograde. I was like, oh my God, when are we doing this? That bit has just got to be on. It's just so amazing.
It
And
was interesting that because I saw that in Edinburgh in 2015, and it's an amazing piece of work. But I was trying to remember at what kind of stage Jack was in his career there, because he was pretty, he was getting pretty well known at that point, wasn't he? He was, he had had he already done Let the Right One In the West End, and that, or was that before?
no, it was this is even before Harry Potter.
Yeah.
I remember having a conversation with him, and him going, look, just so you know, it's gonna blow up big time. I was like, why? He goes, well, they're gonna announce the Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, and my mouth just dropped. And he was like, yeah. I went, okay, but what about my play?
Yeah, exactly. So he was kind of on the cusp, but it was an amazing piece of work, and it was also a piece of work that I think, from my impression, was really, really cut through and got a lot of attention in a really important way, I think. I mean, tell me a bit about the place. Tell me what it was, or tell us what it was
Yeah,
about.
so it's a two-hander. It's a play about a young couple. There's audience address, and basically they're coming to terms with the loss of a child in labor. So they have a stillborn baby. Jack used a kind of like a family experience as the source to kind of like use it to kind of talk about the kind of trauma and how a relationship can shift and change, and what needs to happen for it to kind of come together. And so we find the couple in the present, are they trying to have sex unsuccessfully because it's the first time they're trying after that particular moment. So it goes in and out. It goes in and out to the past and kind of present. And Jack didn't really write it with any kind of framework. He just wrote, Alice and Phil as characters. And then the conversation was like, how do we make this, a Grey Eye show, and how do we put the aesthetics of access kind of front and center to it? Working with Lynnie Arnold, the designer, which I think was just like a huge part of the production. And it was really late. So when we were talking about it, we were kind of going, oh, it's going to be like, in a bedroom, and there'll be lamps, and we'll use lighting, and the actors will kind of manipulate it. And then we read the play, and Lydia was like, no, I don't think that's the right design. Just give me a moment. I need to kind of think about it. And she came back with a design what was like a bird's eye view of the bedroom from the ceiling. So the audience were looking down on
It
this
was
couple.
amazing.
It was, I mean, it just made so much sense.
And it had captioning embedded into the design as well. I remember really clearly, I think it was the first time I'd ever seen that as well. Just the way that the accessibility was just an integral part of the production. It wasn't something tacked on at the end.
And we thought about how we were going to use the captioning. So we came to the conclusion, like, when they're in the present, when they're in the bed together, the character's caption would be on their side of the rug. But when they're talking about the past and they're reliving it, it would be on the headboard. Just to kind of like make sure that those audiences that needed captioning weren't their eyes weren't getting tired by just looking in one place, that we were kind of giving them a kind of 360 as well. And we also had like pre-recorded the audio description, so every performance for blind and visually impaired members of the audience, they could kind of rock up, grab a headset, and have the audio description for any kind of performance as well. So very much in keeping with Grey Eye's aesthetic. But yeah, I think like with the material, with the design, with the performers, it just kind of lit. And I just remember the queues going round. to see the show in Edinburgh, and it was I was it was just like, wow, like people really want to kind of come and see this. But also the trauma afterwards, for people as well, and just having the space for them to, yeah, just to kind of reflect on what they've seen.
So you managed not to sink Grey Eye when you were
Just
temporary
about.
director. Good, it's a good sign. So what came after that? So when did Jenny sort of come back in after the
So
Paralympics?
Jenny came back about 8 months later, and because I hadn't sunk the ship, her and Judith and the board were like, we'd like to keep you on for a bit longer, because it's also about development of people too. And then the contract kept getting renewed, and I was getting the opportunities, and a lot of my work as an actor was around new writing and new work, and so I was kind of like leading on that as associate. And I developed a program called Right to Play, which was, a program for deaf and disabled writers, hooking up with, kind of like mainstream organizations, and getting their kind of input. And it was it, we did our first one, was in the Northwest. We went to the Northeast. We went to the Midlands. And I'd left by this point, but it also went into the Southwest, and it also did some London venues. Two, in fact, I've actually the first one was London, actually, because we came back to London, because then we looked at just performers, disabled writers who were of color, when we kind of came back with the Bush and others as well. So yeah, that was kind of like that was kind of my focus. But then when Sugarwater after Edinburgh did a tour, and it went to the National, when the Shed was kind of around. In its tour, it went to the Royal Exchange, and Sarah Frankham had seen it. Serendipity, Arts Council had a program called Changemakers, and they were inviting applications from people and organizations. And Sarah said, like, we'd love for you to be a part of it. Would you be kind of interested? And I've done so much kind of like advocacy and, championing of artists to buildings. I just thought, what's it going to feel like being in a building on the other side of it? And it wasn't like, I was kind of confined to just being, the disability advocate. Actually, for me, in a weird sort of way, the exchange was university for me, because a lot of my work was new writing. I hadn't really read any of the classic plays and all that kind of stuff, and so we'd be in script meetings, and they're going, well, this really is less like the Crucible. This really kind of feels like the Crucible. And I was like, what's Sheffield got to do with it, and what's Jimmy White got to do with
That's
it? What are you
great.
chatting about? And then so I'd read the plays and read the craft of
That's interesting. So it was kind of, yeah, it was like a kind of self-education period. It was
Yeah, we were lucky, because the exchange had a library of plays, so I would kind of go, well, can I just take this one out and kind of have a read, and also, like, I'd started a family, and they were kind of it was a young one. I've only got one, and he was a little boy. The family hadn't moved up to Manchester because it was only an 18-month contract, so I also had time in the evenings, to just to kind of work and just, yeah, just to kind of educate myself, really. So then when there was work on in the main stage, in that 800, 900 seater, I felt as if I had a purpose of kind of being there, and my voice had a purpose as well. Like, I wasn't kind of blagging yet. I don't really like blagging. It is about hard work, and earning your keep, and earning, and yes, how you kind of gain respect, I think. So the exchange was just it was just incredible, and the openness with which Sarah just kind of allowed me to kind of be. And it with anything, when you're an associate, you really take the successes of people and how people operate and how kind of people work. But also, I also think that you kind of go, oh, that decision or that decision making, I would kind of do it differently. You also kind of learn that. And that's not to say that, there's any respect kind of lost. It just kind of goes, It just kind of speaks to who you kind of
Well,
are.
yeah, exactly. Everyone's got their own tastes and ways of doing things. Did you find a difference sort of watching Sarah work compared to Jenny, not in terms of their personalities, but just in terms of the difference between a building, someone running a building and someone running a company that wasn't building based?
Yeah, I think like, you know, I think like, I think I feel like artistic directors are advocates for loads of different, you know, different communities of people. And I think like with Grey Eye, they are championing deaf and disabled artists, and they're really trying to change the dial for that. And what I saw with Sarah was disability, race, gender, sexuality, all sorts of, you know, stuff that would come under the Equality Act, and trying to make a program of work that was really reflective of the world that we kind of live in, and what Manchester kind of is. So it's not to say the responsibility is any less. It's just different, because you have to be advocates for all these kind of artists, and you've got to hold a lot more. You've got to hold a whole organization. You've got to hold freelancers. You've got to make sure that every part of your being is focused on the delivery of the work, because the box office is one of the biggest incomes for an organization, and you kind of live and die by it. And when it's going well, it's brilliant, and when it's not going well, it's so stressful.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. But then you did go to another building, right? So you went to Birmingham Rep straight after World Exchange.
So after the experience of Grey Eye and the Exchange, I was like, you know, I'm kind of ready to kind of step up. And it was the whole the previous round of changing chairs, musical chairs of
Yeah,
artistic directors.
it was, wasn't it? It
Yeah.
was just an announcement week after week of artistic directors shifting around, going to different buildings, moving here, moving out.
Yeah, and you know, like I said, like, you know, the traumatic experience of one of the interviews that I kind of went for. But I kind of like, you know, landed at Birmingham with Sean and with Rachel, and the three of us were kind of new. So the structure was kind of new to what kind of came before. And you know, the experience of the Exchange really gave, you know, kind of like, you know, gave me a lot. And I wasn't coming in fresh and new. I knew how buildings worked and how people kind of operate and all that kind of stuff. But you know, it wasn't without its challenges. Without wanting to get too much kind of into it, because I've kind of like, you know, processed and kind of moved on. It was difficult. It was difficult, and I think it was just like, it was difficult for me. It was difficult for Sean. It was different. It was just a di and for Rachel, it was just a
Well,
difficult time, because we didn't really know each other. So then we're kind of like stuck together, and we're going, well, go on, make this, you know, £12 million income generating building kind of work. It's tough. It's tough.
So I mean, just for the kind of full context, so you resigned from that role, and there were other complications that, not least because lockdown was happening,
Yeah.
and the decision was taken by the rep to lease a couple of its performance spaces to the Ministry of Justice, kind of as I guess they were sort of temporary courts essentially.
Yeah. The Nightingale
And
Court, so called, yeah.
right. And that was one of the big reasons for you leaving. It didn't sit right with you, and time to move on.
You know, I wasn't for it, but I was part of the senior team, and I felt that the reason why I was there was to, you know, get people to engage in theatre who don't, like, you know, what we do at the Kiln. And I felt that that decision would be detrimental to that. I was right in my opinion, because the artistic community, you know, had such a strong reaction to it, which I knew that they kind of would. And these were people that, you know, I had really great relationships with and had built relationships with. And they felt really kind of let down. And I just didn't feel that I could continue in the role, championing, you know, the idea of diversity when a decision like that has kind of been made. And yeah, I've come into this industry to create change, to make change, to make it better. And I just felt I just couldn't do that when that decision
Did
was taken.
what did you do kind of immediately after leaving that role? I mean, what were the kind of options open to you in terms of theatre work?
I had we it was in early conversations with Paul Ray Cusack and Wes and with the Wells Millennium Center about The Boy with Two Hearts. That was it. That was it, really. Yeah. And actually, I kind of came out and I was thinking, is theater is actually theater now the future for me,
Why do you think that was? Why do you think you were kind of being destabilized to that extent?
because it was also the pandemic, and I was leaving a full-time job, I was leaving a job, it felt that I felt like I'd let people down, both the people in Birmingham and much more kind of widely than that, and I had a lot of upset, and it was exacerbated because we'd all been locked down. We'd all, had the emotions that we kind of had, and I just kind of went, why am I doing what am I, why am I doing what I'm doing, and I was like, yeah, no, I've got this show, and I'll do this show. And then, not too long afterwards, I was fortunate enough to co-direct a single drama for the BBC, then Barbara McAllen. And I thought, actually, maybe this is the direction that I can kind of go in, because I've done a couple of shorts as part of a season on BBC Four as well. And I thought maybe this is maybe my university, my Buckinghamshire University of Film, Media and Production, is kind of like calling me now, and I was going to go into that direction. So that's kind of where I where I was. There was a lot of thinking. There was sort of a lot of self reflection. Going
So,
on.
what brought you back into the theatre fold? How
Indhu
did you see?
Rubisingham.
She's responsible for a lot, isn't she?
She's responsible for a lot. But it wasn't just Indhu. It was like Jenny as well. And I like I said, like I was kind of going, I think me, that's me kind of done with theatre. And in and Indhu kind of look, I'd love for you to come here as as associate. And I
Did
said,
you know her?
I knew of her, of course, and I'd met her a couple of times. But we weren't, there was no real friendship or closeness or anything like that. And she kind of reached out to me whilst I was, contemplating what to kind of do moving forward. And yeah, she said, look, having seen, has she seen Boy with Two Hearts? No, she hadn't seen Boy with Two Hearts there, but she just kind of went like, I'd love to kind of bring you here if that's something that you're kind of open to. And all the conversation that I had with her was like, I'm not sure, I'm not sure. And there was another organization was going, we'd love to bring you here as well. And I was like, and so when I actually spoke to her, I said, look, I have made a decision. And she was like, oh, I said, look, I'd love to be your associate. She was like really shocked, I kind of like handed up.
Did she know what the other organization was?
I don't know, actually, maybe.
It's interesting. So that is fascinating, though, that she didn't know you. She hadn't seen that, the big successful show, The Boy with Two Hearts, that had just been on. And presumably she didn't know that you were on this kind of teetering edge of potentially leaving the industry.
She knew that we'd spoken about that. Yeah, we'd spoken about that, and I think, like, she'd known of my reputation. I mean, she would have known about Sugar Water. She would
No,
have,
of course, she clearly there were good reason for her to call you, but it is just so weird, those calls that come at exactly the right time and lead to some completely different path that you'd never expect.
Honestly, it's like people kind of go, tell us about, when does it tell us about your journey? It's all luck. Honestly, I mean, literally is going back to astrology, the stars align, right? I was at a really low ebb with Birmingham, and back then I wouldn't even have thought I'd be in the position that I'm in now. I mean, I wouldn't have thought I was in the position now when I was was like a 6 year old, 7 year old boy thinking about what I was going to do with my life. But there's just some key moments, like if Sugar Water doesn't happen, I then go to the exchange. You know what I mean? Like, I've just been really, really fortunate, so fortunate.
Yes, you have. Well, yes, I mean, but also, as you said earlier, it's about the hard work as well. It's about the commitment to it and showing that in some way. And you know, it's a I it is a combination of that. It's a combination of hard work, skill, and luck. But luck is the big one, isn't it? It's the one
Luck
that you
is the
can't
big thing.
count on.
I mean, listen, like, retrograde the script, that could have been, Ryan had been, he'd had that script, he'd shown it to people, like, anyone could have jumped in on any time. It just happened that it happened to be when,
Also, because he had had it, as far as I think I spoke to Ivana Jeremiah about this, hadn't Ryan sort of had it under his bed for about 7 or 8 years as well? Like, because Ivana was saying that Ryan had written it before For Black Boys, which is really extraordinary because you see For Black Boys, I mean, those two plays are so completely different, but you see For Black Boys and assume that Retrograde is this kind of a follow-up play that's trying to be completely different and showing someone who's kind of mastering the art of a thriller play, like a really taut thriller play. And actually, the way that I understand it is that he wrote that first and it was just lying dormant for a while until
But I think that really speaks to, the time that he was writing it, the people that were reading it, and maybe not engaging with it in the way that the people are now. I wonder if there's like a discriminatory element to it as well, being quite honest. And this is the reason why it's important, like, diversity in our industry, it should be a flagship kind of thing, because, it's only been like the creative case for diversity from the Arts Council only really happened like about 2010, 20. It's only been 15 years. Before then, when I was an actor, if I think about what my journey was as an actor, I'd be getting more opportunities now, I believe, just irrespective of how good or bad I was. I'd be getting more opportunities now because people understand what the creative case for diversity is, right? And even though Ryan was kind of, he wrote that play in that kind of time frame, it was a black writer writing about that play, right? And even now, when you think about it, how many black writers have written for our biggest stages or in the West End? Or it's still really paltry. I mean, it's not just black writers. You can talk about any kind of, like, ethnicity and or color. It's really kind of low, and there's still so much work to be kind of done around that. But I do think there's an element of discrimination that's kind of part of it.
I wouldn't, I wouldn't be surprised at all if that was the case. You know, I think the idea of I think there's something it's about the expectations that have been set for a 50s set play about kind of Hollywood, about McCarthyism. The pieces of art that exist around that are all by white men. And I guess that does just subconsciously or maybe consciously set an expectation of who's going to be writing that piece or who gets to write that piece. I mean, I guess there's been a kind of parallel shift in terms of grey eye and disability-led work as well. I mean, it did feel like Solid Life of Sugarwater was a real kind of watermark in that as well, and in who's telling the stories, but who's t but what stories are being told as well, and what stories can cut through and start kind of break through into. I mean, Jack's been an extraordinary advocate of that, and yeah, it's sort of, you know, there are these shoots of positivity, but there's still a long way to go.
There is a long way to go, and there is there are there is a there's lots of things to be positive about. There's lots of things that we've got to keep fighting for to make sure we don't kind of lose, particularly in the climate that we're in at the moment. I think, we're so much more richer, we're so much more diverse in the work that we kind of produce because we're encouraging those stories to kind of come through. And like I say, for me, one it I it's not like a new thing, by the way, that I want for the kiln. But I really do believe that, we can hold those stories that are from those communities. I'm not just talking about race here, I'm talking about all sorts of demographics. We can hold those stories here, and that they have an appeal much wider, because I think fundamentally audiences, they just want to be told a really good story. That's why they come back. That's why they come back, because they're optimistic about what they're going to see is going to be really, really good.
Exactly. Thanks so much, Amit. Really good to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
Theatre Voice is an archive of recorded interviews with theatre and performance practitioners. It's held in the V&A's Theatre and Performance Archives, the UK's national collection of performing arts, which are available to consult in the V&A's study rooms.